Thank you for coming and for entering in. We are here for 3 weeks and we're excited at this opportunity that we have just to really think about practically some different topics that have risen through our little questionnaire that we did. And this week we're really going to think about what does it mean to be women of grace in the world. And really where that stemmed from is a few of your responses were in line with thinking through how do we live distinctively as Christian women? What sets us apart? Even though we may do the same job as others, we may be in the same circles as others that are not Christians, how can we be distinctive as Christians and yet still bear the fragrance of Christ and still be different? And so we want to dig into this book of Titus tonight, which some of you may have had the opportunity to read through during the week. And we're going to really focus in on Titus chapter 2 and think about what Paul was writing to Titus and how it applies to us. But as we think about being women of grace in the world, I wanted to see how worldly wise you all are. So I'm going to ask you a question, and this is not like school, so you can just shout out your answer. And so I want to ask you a question. Does anybody know what FOMO means? Shout it out. One person really loud. Fear of missing out. Did you know that? Yes? FOMO. What about YOLO? You only live once. Exactly. So FOMO and YOLO are mantras of our age at this moment in time, it seems. Because you can excuse any type of behavior by saying YOLO, and you can do whatever you want, even though it may not be wise, by saying FOMO, because you don't want to miss out. And so these phrases that have become commonplace, really what's beneath them is the message behind it that says, do it all, have it all, don't miss anything, you're worth it, it's all about you, say yes to it all. And maybe it's just me, or maybe it's the same for you, that no one seems to have the strength of conviction anymore, maybe, to say no. Because it seems to me that we just live in a yes culture. Yes, 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 everything goes. We have referendums that arise over and over again where yes campaigns come with those. And it's unpopular to say no nowadays, isn't it? Where we face pressure to say yes to anything and everything. Whatever you want, if it feels good, you should do it. You're worth it. You should follow your heart. Let it lead you. Don't let anyone tell you that you can't do something. We're to be tolerant. We're to be progressive. We're told that we can be our own authority. We should live our truth. And don't let anyone else tell you otherwise. And so as we turn into Titus 2 tonight, I want us to find Paul, who's writing to Titus, a younger recruit in the faith who's in the island of Crete. And some of you have maybe been on holiday to Crete. Anyone been to Crete on holiday? And so at that time in Crete, much like our culture today, the people in Crete, which are called Cretan people, which I didn't know until I started studying this, the Cretan people were in a self-driven culture too. There's nothing new under the sun. Everyone was saying yes to their own desires, and corruption and lies were just as equally there as they are today. And chapter 1, verse 12 tells us that one of Crete's own prophets said, "Cretans are always liars, evil brutes, lazy gluttons." So they didn't get a very good reference from one of their own people. But what do you think Titus would have felt like as a Christian, an early Christian, a new Christian, trying to start the church at that time? How would he have felt? Maybe lonely, maybe isolated, maybe feeling a little bit overwhelmed, outnumbered by these Cretan people. Maybe similar to how we feel today in whatever our context might be, where we're exposed to our culture and we're challenged to join in with our culture and to live with these mantras that drive our culture, where anything and everything goes. How can the early believers say no in their day? And how can then we today, as women living in a post-Christian society, say no? How can we practice self-denial in an age of self-satisfaction, self-fulfillment, self-focus, a selfie culture? How can we be women that are filled with the Spirit to demonstrate the fruit of the Spirit in our lives? Because a lot of the fruit of the Spirit is not focused on self. All of the fruit of the Spirit is not focused on self. So how can we refuse to give in to the cultural peer pressure that tells us YOLO and has an epidemic of FOMO? How can we say no in the 21st century and yet still bear truth and love and grace in our relationships with those around us? So we're going to look at chapter 2 of Titus. And as we think back just to chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2, to give you a bit of context, Paul talks about the culture of lies and false teaching that these people were living within. And he talks about how what we know to be true should then inform how we live. So what we know then informs how then we live our daily lives. And so for us tonight, I want us to be reminded of and equipped with what we need to know so that then we can live as women that are gracious women in our culture today. And we're going to look specifically at Titus chapter 2, verses 11 through to 14. So if you haven't found Titus yet, if you go to the very end of your Bible to Revelation, you go back and you go past John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Peter and Hebrews, you'll get to Titus. So it's just right near the end, tucked in there. And I want us to see specifically that it isn't self-help or trying harder or doing better with more willpower that will grow us as Christian women, but that God's grace trains us in godliness to live as women of grace in our world. So it's God's grace that trains us in godliness. So let's read this little short passage together from Titus chapter 2, verse 11 to 14. For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people. It teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age, while we wait for the blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good. So Paul moves beneath the surface of what we're to do to then the why and the how. So he's teaching these early Christians living in Crete how they're going to have the strength, how they're going to have the power and the resilience that they need to withstand the fiery trials of their day. And not only that, but to be a witness that would be attractive and that would be beautiful and that would grow the church. Because if we just focus on our actions, if we're just given a list of things to do, I don't know if you're anything like me, but you just get to work on the list. I need to be this, and I need to be this, and I need to be this, without looking at the heart beneath it, then we, as one writer said, we just end up being better behaved lovers of self. So we may be good for a while at behavior modification, you could call it, but if it doesn't go through our heart beneath the surface, we're just being better behaved lovers of self. And that, when I read that, struck me hugely, because how much of the time do we just behave well? And yet whenever maybe the curtains are closed, when no one else sees, at home, wherever it is for you, that's not who we really are. And so with the foundation we can look at tonight of thinking through this grace that teaches us, we'll be able to see how then we can live as women of grace in our culture. So first of all tonight, I want us to see in verse 11 that God's grace saves us. Nothing revolutionary, nothing new that you haven't heard before, but let's be reminded then tonight that God's grace saves us. For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people. So what has come? What has appeared? The grace of God. And in this whole passage from verse 11 to verse 14, that's just one long sentence in the original language in the Greek. And the grace of God is the grammatical subject for our English folks out there that love a bit of grammar. The grace of God is the subject of that whole sentence. So we need to stop then and pay attention, don't we? What is grace then? We hear it a lot. You might be very familiar with lots of different ways you can define grace. But one way I've always remembered it is as an acronym, God's riches at Christ's expense. God's riches at Christ's expense. His active, unmerited favor towards wicked, unworthy sinners, where he delivers them from condemnation and delivers them from death, bestowing the greatest gift upon those who deserve the greatest punishment. Johnny has spoken about it before, but he's told the story about our Maisie and how we try to really be parents that teach grace in our home, and so every time we don't give the discipline that's due for the whatever misbehavior has gone on, we say, this is grace. So we're not going to give you the consequence. We're going to say, no, that's okay. We'll continue with our day, probably most of the time because we can't follow through on the consequence that we first threatened with. So we say, this is grace. You're not going to get it, Maisie. And so she's, you know, delighted. So she, for a while, thought we were doing really well. We were getting quite self-righteous about our parenting. And then all of a sudden she did something wrong. And we decided, no, that's something that we need to maybe enforce the threat and now go along with the consequence. And she yelled at us at the top of her voice, but you always show me grace. And so she was then angry at us that we weren't showing her the grace, and she was nearly threatening us that we weren't being good parents because we should be gracious. And yet the bottom line is that we can't demand grace. We can't stand and shout that we deserve grace. That's what our rebellious hearts want to do, don't they? They want us just to say, oh, well, grace covers everything, so therefore we can live however we please, because sure, we have grace and we're entitled to it. No, no. Grace is when we understand this little quote for ourselves, and not for everyone else around us, but for ourselves. And Tim Keller uses it. I'm not quite sure where the origin of it is exactly, but it says, we're more sinful and flawed than we ever dared believe, but more loved and welcomed than we ever dared hope. We're more sinful and flawed than we dared believe, but we're more loved and more welcomed than we ever dared hope. That's what grace is. That's true grace. But it doesn't just exist as this divine attribute of a God that exists in heaven. But look what it says about this grace. It says, this grace has appeared. And so the grace of God has not just become public for all to see, but it's actually become personified in the person of Jesus. So grace that was once concealed has come into our darkness, has intersected our path. The light has turned on in our darkness because of the appearance of grace in human form, coming to rescue us, as the next verse, part of the verse tells us then, that it brings salvation. It offers salvation. But what does it not say when we look at this verse 11? It doesn't say Jesus appeared bringing condemnation and motivation to try harder to save ourselves. No, grace appeared in Jesus Christ and he brought with him our salvation. So he brought with him rescue. He brought with him release from the penalty of sin. We were heading for death until Jesus graciously appeared, stepping into our darkness and bringing with him our salvation. And so the only time we're mentioned is in what we receive. It's not what we bring to contribute to our salvation. It's not any kind of good things that we can offer and suggest that God might look upon and be pleased with. No, we don't bring anything. We simply receive. Because salvation is not by our works, but it's by grace alone, through faith in the person and work of Jesus. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9 tells us, for it is by grace you have been saved through faith, not as a result of works, lest no one can boast. And so, because grace isn't by our own accomplishment or our own goodness, and it's not by our station or our class, we look at the end of verse 11 and we say, who is this grace available for? All people, all men or women, all peoples. And if we glance back just up the chapter 2, just to verses 1 to 10, it shows us that Paul's been speaking about all kinds of people earlier on in this chapter. He talks about servants and masters, male and female, young and old. There's no restriction on who can receive salvation by grace on the basis of their age or gender or class or measure of personal holiness or sinfulness. Spurgeon said, "Even to the liars, the evil beasts, the lazy gluttons, the gospel has come to them too." So God's grace doesn't discriminate, and it's available to all. So no one is beyond the reach of his grace. What a challenge for us, maybe, as we look out on our world. We look out on our world that seems so desperate and dying before us. And yet we look out at people maybe that we write off as being too far away from grace. That grace can't reach them. Who maybe have we lost hope for? And how can we pray that God might reveal his grace to them, bringing salvation, that light into their darkness, that intersection on the path that they're heading on? But this grace doesn't just bring us salvation and leave us sitting there waiting for our future with God one day in heaven when we may get there. No, this grace, it changes us. It should change us, because a true response to grace is a change in our life. It's not just that we sit with our golden ticket and wait to get to heaven and not allow grace to transform us internally. Grace produces a response, and it should produce a response in our life. And that's our second point as we move into verse 12, that God's grace sanctifies us. God's grace sanctifies it. It first saves us, and then it sanctifies us. This is not rocket science, but it's helpful to be reminded of. I find it so helpful to be reminded of this week. So let's read verse 12 together. Thinking of grace, it teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age. So we've received grace, but that doesn't mean we should just live how we please, does it? Where we know we'll be given grace for every misdemeanor on the way. No, we should be changed in how we live. We should experience a heart change where God's grace breaks sin's power and sin's dominion in our lives, and gives us a new nature that desires holiness, desires obedience. And that's what this sanctification is, because this life as a Christian, from whatever the day is that we become a Christian, for the rest of our life until the Lord takes us to be home with him, is a time of sanctification, which is like a two-sided process of one side becoming less and less like our old sinful self, and more like Christ. So less of ourselves and more of Christ, the restoring of the image of God in each of us individually, to reflect him, to glorify him in our day-to-day lives. So let's remind ourselves of why Paul's writing this book. Because in chapter 1, verse 1, he says, "The knowledge of the truth leads to godliness." The knowledge of the truth then leads to godliness. So then let's see and follow this argument then by how. How do we learn to become godly? Well, grace becomes our teacher. That's what this section's all about in verse 12, that grace then becomes our teacher. It trains us, it instructs us, it educates us, it nurtures us, it gently guides us. It's not passive, it's not inactive, it's actively teaching and training us. And I know for some of us in the room, it's been a very long time since our first day at school. For others, over here in this corner, I'm seeing younger girls where the first day of school might still be a memory in your mind, where you remember that first day going into school. But when we receive grace for the first time, and when we experience salvation in Jesus, we are immediately enrolled in the school of grace. So you may not know it, but you actually are a student, and you actually are a pupil in the school of grace. We are lifelong students. There's no graduation in this life, and we don't get a report in progress at the end of term, but our progress reports in producing spiritual fruit. That's the fruit of the Spirit that each student grows in and bears witness to those watching on, as students appear different in comparison to the rest of the world. And so if we're enrolled in this school of grace, then who is our teacher? It's Jesus, isn't it? The one that came as grace personified. He's our teacher. He's our guide. He's our counselor. And what does he teach us then? Well, first of all, Paul writes that he teaches us in the negative. He teaches us to say no. He teaches us to say no, first of all, to ungodliness and worldly passions. So to renounce or to deny, to turn away from that which is sinful or destructive. Another word that you could describe it as is to forsake, to say no. And this verb, again, for you grammar people, is a continuous verb. It's not just something we do one day when we wake up and that's us done forever. It's continuous, so we're always ongoing. We're going to say no regularly, to deny regularly, to turn away regularly. And so Jesus said himself, the number one lesson in the school of grace with the basics of Christian discipleship is that if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, pick up his cross, and follow me. So we're to learn what it means to say no, not just to lots of other things, but to say no to ourselves, to say no to those desires that rise up in our hearts, to deny ourselves if we want to follow Jesus. So what are we going to turn our backs from? Well, first of all, it talks about this ungodliness. But what is ungodliness? Well, some people describe it as a lack of reverence or devotion to God, where maybe our lives bear no witness to God. We don't acknowledge him in how we live. Could this be the way others describe us, maybe? Or are we women that show that we acknowledge and have a devotion to God in our daily lives? It also teaches us to say no to worldly passions and desires. Worldly passions, and this relates to things that are in our present life. Sins, maybe, that we may not actually commit in full, but we long to. Lusts, cravings. Let's just for a moment just take a wee sidestep, and I want us to consider the first appearance of ungodliness and worldly desires in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3, verses 4 and 6. When Eve is being tempted, what was it that tempted Eve? What did she desire? Was she just hungry? Was there not lots of other fruit to be enjoyed in the garden? She thought the fruit looked good. It was pleasing to the eye and would be satisfying to taste, yes. But what did it offer her that she didn't already have? That's what she desired, to be like God. She didn't want to miss out. She experienced FOMO for the first of all times. But what does the world desire today? Is it not just exactly the same, to be like God? To be like him in ways that we're not maybe created to be? To take on characteristics of a limitless God, even though we're created to be dependent on him? And you maybe say, are we not meant to reflect the image of God in our lives? Are we not created to actually be like God? Yes, we are to bear his image, but in certain ways, not in every way. We're to bear his image by the fruit of the Spirit in our lives, in the conduct of love and kindness and compassion and mercy and graciousness to a world that watches on. But we can only reflect his image to a certain extent. We can't be wholly a reflection of God before others, because there's certain aspects of the character and the person of God that are only true for him, that are not true of us as the creation. He's the creator and we're the creation. And so he is the one that can only be judge. He is the one that can only be all-powerful, to be all-knowing, to be omnipresent in all places at all times, to be an authority over all things, to be worshipped by all people. And yet so much of the time, I think for me, and maybe same for you, that we want those characteristics more than we actually want the fruit of the Spirit in our lives. We want to be like God too. I don't know if you have a love-hate relationship with technology like I do, where we love the benefits of technology and how it saves us so much time and helps us have all this information, but yet we hate it on the other hand, don't we? Because we become dependent on it and we get frustrated when it doesn't work. But I wonder, is the problem more of a heart issue with it? Because technology has afforded us this impression that we can be like God. We can be all-knowing because we have Google. There is nothing I cannot know if I have my phone and I can look it up quickly for you. We can be omnipresent with our work, with our social schedule. We can have constant access to emails, to internet, to FaceTime. We can be everywhere at all times. We can sit on our armchair and scroll through the news and social media and become the judge of everybody else that we don't even have to be around because we don't want to be around them, but we can still judge them from our armchair. We can assess whether in light of them we're better or we need to try harder. We can be worshipped via our carefully created and edited pictures that we share online that have this readily waiting audience that want to either like it or not like it. We can be worshipped too through technology. So sometimes technology can make us feel like we're the god of our little kingdom. And every time we get a like on a page or another morsel of information or knowledge to devour, we feel like God. We feel like we know more, and we like that. And at the root of all sin, one writer said, is our rebellious desire to be like God, a desire that first existed way back in the Garden of Eden. We want the worship of all people. We want control over all of our circumstances and those around us. We want things to serve us and people to serve us, and we want pleasure without any parameters. And just like Adam and Eve, we ignore the grace of God. We overlook the rest of the garden that we've been given to enjoy, and we focus on the one thing that we can't have. And we wonder if God is really good, if we can trust him for his word, or do we believe lies? Do we trust the parameters or the boundaries that he sets? Do we trust that we can find satisfaction within those? Or do we think that we need to look outside of those things and worship something else, something like control, something like pleasure? Because Romans chapter 1, verse 25 tells us that all sin is an exchange, where instead of worshiping the Creator, we've ignored the truth of God. And we've said yes to a lie, believing that it will satisfy us. And we worship and serve the creation instead of the Creator. We worship ourselves, we worship others, we worship things, and we worship how they make us feel. We worship the power that they might give us. We worship the identity they might afford us. But grace teaches us then to say no. It teaches us to say no, not just to things, but to the lies that come with those things. It teaches us to say no to the lies and the desires that we may have for them. So let's flesh this out a bit further and just try and be practical for a wee second. We may have a desire to have the approval of everyone around us. We take pride in people's praise, and yet we fear their judgment, and we might fear the shame that could come with it. And so at times we maybe are so consumed with what other people think, but by grace, if we think of grace, we're accepted, we're loved, we have a new identity as children of God. And I wonder, do we spend our days and our years ignoring that love of God, demonstrated by God's grace, and spend all our time seeking to secure the praises of those around us, rather than running to God and seeking to bear his image, and bearing the image of a God that came humbly, that took on the form of a servant, that came to seek and save the lost, to be scorned and rejected, a man of sorrows who wasn't esteemed? Do we focus on the praises of others, or do we focus on being like Christ, who came and wasn't praised? And that's the God that we have our heritage and our identity within. Or maybe you're like me, where you love control, and you want to have control over all things, and we can ignore the grace that teaches us to trust God and to trust his control over all things. We wrestle him for control, we manipulate others, we're full of anxious fear at times, and yet we could trust in a God who holds all things together in the palm of his hands, though it is hard at times. We can trust in the God whose eye is on the sparrow, who clothes the lilies of the field, who knows each circumstance we face, who knows everything about us and can bring good out of evil, can bring beauty out of ashes for his good purpose. I wonder, are we women that have an ability to say no in a certain area of our life? Are we bowing to worldly desires, or are we living self-controlled lives? Because that's what the rest of the verse teaches us. Because it turns this little word no around, and if you turn the word no around, what do you get? on. So it tells us then what positively we're to put on in response to God's grace. Yes, we say no to desires, we identify the lies, but what then are we to put on? We're to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age. And so grace teaches us not just to say no to everything about the world and wander off into our holy huddle and stay together and wait until heaven comes. No, no, no. It teaches us then to put on these things. It teaches us to act. Saying no to something means saying yes to something else. And so when we say no to ungodliness and worldly desires, we're saying yes to living self-controlled, which is internally, where we have control over ourselves, self-mastery, where we have a control over our heart's desires, over our thinking, over the lies, what's coming into our life. We control what we're absorbing. We control what we're contemplating or consuming. We control maybe how we're enjoying entertainment. Are we really enjoying it? Should we evaluate that more? We ask ourselves hard questions, and that's what self-control is, to live sensibly, to be sober-minded. We live up, to live upright and righteous lives, and that's talking about being upright with one another. So first of all, internally self-control, and then to live upright, righteous lives before one another, externally, where we live with honesty, justice, full of integrity, the fruit of the Spirit pours out to those around us. And then lastly, godly lives. And that's talking about our relationship vertically then with God. So internally, horizontally with others, and then vertically with God, where we're not self-centered, but we have a God-centeredness about us, where we live all of life in awareness of our absolute dependence on God. And that then might make you look like an alien, to be honest, in your culture, to live like that. Wherever it might be, whether it's in school, at university, at college, in work, at home, in your community, you may look different from everybody else if you choose to say no to ungodliness and worldly desires and yet say yes to self-control, say yes to upright living, and say yes to godliness. And yet, how can anyone not be intrigued or attracted to a woman of grace who lives self-controlled, righteously, and upright in her community? Do you not think people might ask, why? Why do you say no to that? And that we might be able to say it's because of grace. Let me tell you about grace. And so, indulgence of ungodliness and worldly passions, although they may be the ultimate denial of the Word of God, if our lives exhibit no freedom from these passions, then what difference has the gospel really made? If we just look the same as everybody else, say yes to the same things as everybody else, then what difference is there in our lives in this present age? Because grace is great, and I wonder if you, like me, have said at times, I've heard it all before, Jenny. I've heard it all before. I've heard about grace. Grace is good. But I need new steps to help me change. It's not good enough to get me through. And it reminds me maybe of a time whenever I was moved within in my heart and I was changed internally, but it doesn't make a difference anymore. I don't feel anything anymore. But I wonder if you, in your pursuit of godliness, have left Jesus behind. I wonder, are you allowing him to be your teacher? I wonder if you're more focused on your performance for him than on his performance for you. And at the end of the day, is there a rest in your soul because of him? Or is there a guilt or a determination to try harder and do better? Because that is the point. We can't conjure up this godliness. We can't stir it up within us and have a sustained life of godliness without grace at the foundation of that, without Jesus at the center of that. And I don't know about you, but I am so forgetful. I have got so much more forgetful in the last 8 years. I call it postnatal amnesia. I don't know if there's a diagnosis for it, but I definitely am a prime candidate for it because I forget everything. I can't remember my children's names. People say, did you have a nice weekend? I have no idea what I did this weekend. And so I am forgetful. And if you're like me, we forget. And we so quickly forget. And one writer said, as I was studying this, It's not new truths that we need. We need old truths recently forgotten. So that's the bottom line. This is not rocket science, but we need to be women that turn back over and over and over again to those old truths. And so if you want to take time when you go home to read through the next two verses, verse 13 and 14, those are old truths that I'd forgotten, where we think ahead to the future. And that's what this whole little passage teaches us. It teaches us the past tense, that Jesus has appeared, the grace of God has appeared in the past, verse 11. Verse 12, that we're to live this life of godliness in this present age. It goes into the present tense. And then verse 13 and verse 14 talks about the future hope while we wait for our blessed hope, the appearing of Jesus Christ again. And so in this little tiny passage in Titus, Paul asks us to do what is physically impossible, to look in opposite directions at exactly the same time, to look back at grace gone by in our salvation in Jesus coming, and yet to look ahead, to be suspended between the already and not yet, and to somehow, with our focus on Christ, navigate wherever it is that God has you right now, which he knows exactly where that is, that we might be women that can be women filled with grace, and that we're correctly orientated within that, so that we might be a witness for him in our day and our generation. And I've got one last question for you before we go to discussion groups. Does anybody know, and this is the true test of your streetwiseness, does anybody know what JOMO is? The joy of missing out. So Domino's Pizza have this amazing advertising campaign at the moment that talks about JOMO. And I am all about JOMO because they want to say that there's absolute joy in missing out and going out and getting pizza delivered and staying in, which I totally agree with. But there is a joy, a greater joy than what this world might offer. And at times it's very hard to say no, but we can experience JOMO, where we have a joy in missing out. When we say no to worldly desires and ungodly passions, and to follow Christ on the path of grace, where we live self-controlled, righteous, and godly lives, because there's a much greater joy in serving Jesus, in living our lives for Jesus, the one that came, that brings us salvation by grace, and that will return again and take us to be with him forever. When we keep that in our minds, when we keep that perspective, that helps us. That helps us to say no. It's not easy. It's really hard. But let's be women that try and keep that perspective so that we can be women of grace in the world. Let's just pray together quickly before then we go into our discussion time. God, we thank you for your word. We thank you that your word sanctifies us because your word is truth. We thank you that you, Jesus, came as truth and grace, filled with truth and grace to teach us, to bring us salvation, to take on the punishment that we deserved. I thank you for your grace in my life. I thank you for your grace in the lives of the women here tonight. I pray that your grace would transform our hearts, that we won't be women that forget grace and think it's just for salvation, but that we would be women that apply grace into our hearts every day for our sanctification, that we might be women that bear your image and that bear your grace to those that we meet tomorrow. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. So we're going to move quickly into our discussion time. Some of your groups are humongous, some of them are okay, but if you want to do split a group down the middle and do half and half, that's completely fine. We've got four questions in our booklet. We are going to, if we have time, feedback a little bit. And so we're going to give you, let me see, about 15 minutes, 7 o'clock, we're going to close up. So we're going to have time to go through our questions, but we're going to do something different, so you have to listen and pay attention, because we're not all going to start at question number one. We're all going to start on a different question so that we get feedback from the different questions. So you may not get to question four, like most groups never do. So we want some groups to do question four first, controversial. So we're going to do, some of our groups are going to start with number one. So can this group over here start with number one? That's easy. Can this group start with number two? Can this group start with number three? You're going to start with number four. And then you're going to start with number one. And then you're going to start with number two. You're going to start with number three. number four back there, and this group number one and two. I think you girls could split, couldn't you, you ladies? That'd be okay. And then back there, number three, is that okay? Great. So we're going to have about 15 minutes. In your group, if there's someone there to take down a few notes as to what you're kind of thinking, and then we'll have an opportunity to share back again afterwards. Ladies, I hate to interrupt your conversations because I love listening to you all talking together and laughing, but we're going to wind up our conversation. But what I'm going to do is, rather than have a time of feeding back where everybody tells us what they've been talking about, we're going to I'll get some of that feedback from your group leaders. So if somebody in the group was jotting down a few things that you were talking about, then if you can come and either pass that to me or have a wee chat with me, that's really helpful for us just to feed back together and to know what we've kind of been growing in and learning and what we've been thinking. But just before we sing to close, I just want to recommend a few books that Gary has here with a little book stall. So these are special books that we have thought through. Each week there'll be books that are relevant to the topic that we're looking at. So I just want to run through them really fast. If this is something that I was talking about earlier, thinking through how we're made in the image of God and yet we don't reflect him in every way, and yet we reflect him in certain ways. This book is called In His Image by Jen Wilkin. She does have one called, what's the one about? Oh, about God. It'll come to me. I'm so forgetful. It's my memory. But In His Image is really good, and it's about 10 ways God calls us to reflect his character. And so these are things that are true of us and how we can reflect him. This is a really helpful book that I found helpful a long time ago. It's called Because He Loves Me, Thinking Through How the Gospel Applies to Our Daily Living and Our Sanctification as We Grow as Christians. It's by a lady called Elise Fitzpatrick, Because He Loves Me. And then this one I find really helpful when thinking through just with our children, how we don't get our children to scream at us, "You always give me grace." And so how to really teach them what grace means, but also at times having to be hard and to discipline. And so it's called Risen Motherhood, and it talks about gospel hope for everyday moments. And I find it incredibly helpful. So that's a good one if you're working with little ones. And then another two that are really helpful, and I think this is a really good avenue to go down if you're just looking for examples of what this looks like, are biographies. And these are two missionary biographies that I have loved reading, and I've read this one multiple times. It's the biography of Anne Judson, who is the wife of Adoniram Judson, and they have an amazing story. And so this book will make you cry. It's incredibly sad, but also incredibly encouraging, of the life of Anne Judson, a missionary life for Burma. And so that's written by Sharon James, and it's a really, really good read. It used to be called My Heart in His Hands, and they've changed the name for some reason. And then this is a local author, Maud Kells. This is her book, An Open Door, and it talks about her story of courage in the Congo. And again, if you're looking for examples of what it means to be women of grace, living in a world that's really, really hard, these will encourage your heart. So do pick up a biography, and hopefully they'll encourage you. So what we're going to do is we're going to sing, and then Tanya's going to come up at the end and close us off in a time of prayer. So if our lovely girls can come, we're going to sing together Amazing Grace as a response to what we've heard. Pardon? None Like Him. That's the other book, None Like Him by Jen Wilkin. Google told her because she knows everything. Thanks, Jenny. Thank you, girls.